You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. We are visiting with Ksenia Melnik. She is the author of the book Snow in May. It recently was released, and it is a compilation of short stories. It takes place in Magadan, an isolated fishing and mining town in the northern reaches of Russia that once served as a transit center for prisoners dispatched to Stalin's labor camps. So if that doesn't grab your attention right away, I don't know what is. But Ksenia is with us here in the studio. We were very fortunate to have her here. She's here in El Paso. And so we're going to talk with her right now about her book and a little bit about her background, because I'm sure you're curious about her growing up and what drove her to write these stories about Russia back then. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, you have recently written the book Snow in May, and it's a compilation of short stories, not just about women, but men and women. And it's everything from love stories to doctors and people coming to the United States after being there for a while. But anyway, it gives us an inside look at living in the Soviet Union. And people might wonder, well, I wonder what it was like for her growing up. So I'm going to throw it back to you and ask you, what was it like growing up, Ksenia?
Sure. Well, growing up for me was very different than what my characters experience in the book. I look at my childhood as pretty idyllic. I lived in Magadan, which, as you mentioned, is in the northeast of Russia. And in fact, to orient people with geography, I like to mention that it was closer to Alaska than to any major Russian town. And there used to be direct flights there, just 4 hours. So we are really in the eastern part of Russia, very far from Moscow. Moscow was about 8 hours. And people refer to the rest of Russia as continent or the mainland, as if Magadan is an island, just because it's so far away, it's so isolated. And before there were many flights there, of course, people had to take a train 2 weeks, then take a steamship. So, but for me, you know, my childhood was great. Of course, when a child grows up, like, you don't have that many needs. You have your friends, you have your school, it's snowing, you go skating, you go skiing. My parents really protected me from any kind of realizations of hardships or any political aspects. And to be honest, I didn't even know about the dark history of Magadan when I lived there. I only found that out when I moved to Alaska at 15, and then I was living in New York after college, and I started writing these stories and started doing some research about Russian general in my town in particular. And then it struck me, like, wow, this is where I'm from. I had no idea there were some memorials in town, some, you know, there was some conversation that I maybe picked up, but I wasn't quite aware just what kind of place it was. So really the only hardship we experienced was in the 90s when the Soviet Union collapsed and many people were out of work and not getting paid. And the stores had all these import products from abroad that started coming in, but people couldn't afford them unless they were these like new Russian businessmen. But luckily, my father already started working in Alaska at that point, so he was able to send some money and even send some food for us. So it was okay for us, you know. Other people, I have no idea how they managed. And then we moved in 98. But I look fondly on my childhood, my time in Magadan, my travels in the continental Russia. So my characters have much more difficult situations in the story, I must say.
Well, I would imagine that, you know, one of the reasons that you did put these characters on paper is because these are like historical fiction. And the fact that these people did go through these things, and some older people might look at you and say, well, you're too young to remember, and perhaps even your parents are too young, and I'm sure they are. But as you mentioned, there were some dark days, and Stalin was just a man who was feared. And I know you mentioned, you know, in the book, at least it's assumed Stalin's already dead. You know, there's plenty of stuff to go, and you share that in the first story, and we'll get into that in just a minute. But what about when people approach you and ask you, was it difficult getting away from Russia? Did you hear any stories from your grandparents? But as you mentioned, you really didn't know anything about that until you left.
Yes, and as you mentioned, the stories in the collection are all set like 58 and on. So after Stalin died and after the most of the camps were in the process of being dismantled, and it's a shadow in the book. It affects people. It's in their past, and it certainly affects people who live in Magadan, because I didn't realize it, but they knew what kind of town they were living in. You know, I did have to do a lot of research because, I didn't know anything. And in fact, I take this very seriously. Like, to me, it's not enough to just mention Stalin, mention the camps for shock value, or just to indicate some exoticism, to indicate my book is like serious or important or has historical gravity of a certain weight. So I did a lot of research. I read a lot of books. I watched movies. I talked to my family members and their friends. And so a lot of these stories are kind of adapted from family lore, but what can be a few sentences just, you know, in around the kitchen table drinking tea. Of course, when you start writing the story, that's not enough. You have to fill in a lot from research and from imagination. The person who sort of contributed most about the past, the dark era, is my grandfather. He was not in the camp, but he moved to Magadan in, I believe, 58 or 59, maybe 57, somewhere around that time. So he came in to work as a petroleum engineer. And when he arrived there, there were still camps there. There were Japanese prisoners of war building main streets in town, the park, the sports club. Even my dad, who was born in 52, remembers prisoners building some actual residential building across from when he was living. So I just remember hearing that in back way in childhood and just kind of not really registering what that really meant. And so when I started writing the book, and I mean, it took a long time for it to come together. I wasn't sure it's going to center around Magadan or people's connections around it. First, I was just, you know, writing random short stories. Some of them set in Russia, some of them set in New York. But then I called him and I said, what were you telling me back then, you know, my grandpa, when I was young, about the way Magadan used to be in the 50s and 60s? Tell me again. I was able to talk to him as a grown-up with a more historical understanding, and then it was even more fascinating to me because he was working with people who were still prisoners or people who were just released, and there were people from all walks of life and, you know, great specialists, and to me it was just so interesting.
Now, once you talked, like you said, as an adult to your dad, and you decided that you were going to put this into a book, how long did it take you to put this together? And was it a hard sell to publishers because of the content?
Well, the oldest story that ended up in the collection, I actually started in 2004, so just after I graduated from college, and I started it as a short screenplay. I wanted to make a short film out of it. I always knew, of course, that I wanted to write or be a storyteller, but I was really into films. Like, I was thinking maybe I'll work on independent film. And then I saw just how hard it is to get people and money together. And I thought, I'll turn this into a short story rather than try to get funding for a film. But anyway, so since 2004, as I was living in New York, and then I was, you know, attending grad school, the last story that made its way into the collection, I started in 2011. And then, of course, you know, there were many, many revisions with agents and editors. So it was almost 10 years, if you count the writing and the publishing, with the book being out on the bookshelves in May. So it took a very long time. But, of course, I was writing other material during that time. In terms of it being a hard sell, I actually thought it was kind of a plus. I got the idea that people were interested because we've heard immigrant stories coming from Moscow and St. Petersburg, you know, Leningrad. And of course, I don't really consider this book to be about immigrants. There are a couple of stories that are set in the U.S., but it's not really focused on the immigrant experience. So I got a sense that it wasn't compared to other quote-unquote immigrant fiction. It was something different. It was like you said, historical fiction. So I thought it set it a little bit apart. And people were interested. And even in my workshops, when I took just workshops in the New School at NYU, my classmates were always fascinated by the time period. So
we are speaking with Ksenia Melnick, and she is the author of Snow in May, a collection of short stories. They're set in the Magadan, as Ksenia mentioned, an isolated fishing and mining town in the northern reaches of Russia, closer to Alaska than it is to the Soviet Union, and once served as a transit center for prisoners dispatched to Stalin's labor camps. So let's talk a little bit about Snow in May. Well, first of all, it's just a wonderful title, especially because we're here in the Southwest and it's an awful summer. And as I mentioned, these are stories that the reader will be brought into the book, and all of a sudden they are there, the way you write, and they can experience the short halls, the crowded apartments, the fact that they have to share a bathroom, they have to share a kitchen. You know, people are going, wow. In the first story, you write about Tanya, and I'm not going to give the story away, but it's interesting the way you open the story. It goes from, you know, an airplane, and people can picture being in an airliner. But then all of a sudden, you're in one of those apartments. And then you're also in one of those department stores, and you realize, gosh, I wouldn't stand in line for that long for doing something. I mean, people do that maybe on Black Friday after Thanksgiving, but the fact that they have to stand in line, and then they hear moaning because they've run out of the Finnish snow boot. Tell us about that experience, because, again, Americans are used to just coming and going, buying what they want, leaving, but not the fact that they have to stand in line for hours and then buying what they have. Like, she buys the snow boots for her boys, and they're like two sizes too big because they have to grow into them. As you mentioned, money is tight, so you have to make it stretch.
Yeah. The story, Love Italian Style, or In Line for Bananas, it's the first story in the collection, and I think it fits in nicely in the sense that most of the story is set in Moscow, where a working young mother of two boys, she's doing a lot of shopping. She's actually propositioned by an Italian soccer player for a rendezvous, and she is so shocked because during this time, Soviet people didn't have much contact with foreigners. It was kind of frowned upon. And also, if you live in the far-flung provinces, you really wouldn't have a chance unless you're working in some cultural or governmental or Intourist, which was this big tourist organization that handled all foreign travel. You really wouldn't come in contact with a foreigner. And so when this Italian soccer player on the plane talks to her, it's like the god came from the sky and noticed her, because she's all in planning her shopping itinerary and just like stressed out about all the things she needs to find in Moscow. So that is contrasted with her hunt, and I mean everyone's hunt, for these imported things and clothes because they were of better quality. And of course, I was not alive in the 70s, and this is actually, I had to talk to my mom and dad about the shopping aspect, because really, the travel was connected with shopping, and it was such a purposeful thing. And even growing up in the 80s, I remember my dad would go on business trips to Moscow, and then later on to even Japan and China, and waiting for him to bring presents and specific coats. I remember even when we went to Turkey in the late 90s, and our purpose there was to get these winter coats. And that was like one of the big things we were supposed to accomplish on our vacation. So it was just waiting for gifts, waiting for specific shoes. And each product is associated with a certain country, like shoes and say underwear is Italian. And of course, in the story, Tanya knows by heart, like the best boots are from this country and the best shirts would be from that country. And most of them are the Eastern European bloc countries who were somewhat cooperative with the Soviet Union. Like if you get makeup from France, it's like, wow, you know, best thing ever would be sold in this one store only in Moscow. So I did talk to my dad about it a lot, just the experience of shopping and then traveling all the way to Magadan carrying all of that, and even food, certain items of food. And I do have to say that Magadan was not the worst when it came to supplies in the Soviet Union, because Magadan was a kind of special town. It's very rich in gold and other natural resources. So after the Gulag era ended, they had to motivate people to move there and develop the region and work. So people got higher salaries than people in the rest of Russia. So in terms of what was in the stores, what was on the shelves, Magadan was not the poorest of them all. But again, not like Moscow, of course. And I just remember even my mother talking what happiness she felt when she would get like a pair of good snow boots for us. It's just, it does not compare to a sale or even Black Friday. And that's why people almost didn't use the word buy, because it wasn't even really about money. They used the word get. It was about finding something. And if you have friends or connections at a department store, you know, God bless you. That's why there was kind of this barter system. Somebody works in airlines, they're going to put away some tickets for you for in line. Somebody works in some other place, maybe they'll be able to procure something for you. And the more friends and connections you had, the more you were able. It's not a market system, you know. It's more of a barter, connection, favor-based system. But when you got those Italian boots, you know, that made your year, especially when you got something for your children and you live in the north, like the snow suits that she's on the hunt for. I mean, it's just like winning a lottery.
Now, as far as the experience that you put us through in that first story, as you mentioned, Tanya is all of a sudden recognized and she feels special because her husband really doesn't pay much attention to her. Not that you don't imply anywhere that he is mean to her or abuses her, but the fact that he's just there as a husband, works and whatever he needs to do. But all of a sudden, somebody recognized her and she's special. She looks in the mirror even when she is in the bathroom at the airport and says, wow, this is really cool. And when she gets home, she's greeted by her aunt, Rosa. And all of a sudden, you hear this woman who is screaming at her because she has just bumped into her little boy's bicycle. And all of a sudden, you're going, wait a minute, who is this woman? And you feel like you want to protect Tanya as far as a reader goes. Tell us, is that the way it was? Was there jealousy among some people? Was there mixed social statuses where they lived?
Well, maybe this is a little bit confusing, but Tanya goes on a conference in Leningrad, and she's stopping over in Moscow to go back to Magadan. So her aunt lives in Moscow,
okay.
And she just has one day in Moscow to do the shopping and then return to Magadan. She's going to stay with her aunt, who lives in the communal apartment, Komunalka. The communal apartment was, at this time in the 70s, much more common in the bigger cities because just more people lived there, and the housing, the way they built the houses wasn't quick enough. So in newer cities like Magadan, they already had Khrushchevkas, these apartment buildings with smaller apartments, but that are your own apartment and you didn't have to share it with anyone. But in Moscow, still, if you were kind of a middle-of-the-road citizen, not connected to the party, not connected to any privileged class, you would most likely live in a room in the Komunalka where, I mean, it really could be anywhere from, I forget the numbers, but, you know, 5, 10, perhaps more families, and they would share a bathroom usually, and they would share a kitchen, and there would be very rigid rules about, you know, what are the common areas, what is the schedule for the bathroom. So this is actually something that Tanya is not that familiar with, living in Magadan in her own little apartment. And, I mean, Komunalkas are this cultural staple in the Soviet culture. There are so many movies about it, so many books and so many jokes about it. And it could be stressful. I mean, it depends what kind of historical period it is. If it's, you know, Stalinism and people are denouncing each other, I mean, you could have informers living, you know, in the next room over behind a thin wall. In the 70s, it's just the practicalities of life were so much harder. Like, you had to work so much harder and maneuver so much more to make to cut out a little corner of private life. And I think privacy is the big issue. And I think this runs through the whole collection. Just women wanting to better life and how in every decade, it's kind of this comparison. Like I have a story that's in the 50s and the young woman, what her dreams and circumstances are. And that's compared to Tanya in the 70s. And then I have a story that's in the 90s with a mail order bride and sort of what her life was in Russia and what her life is in America. And I was tracing how it's never enough. You know, well, we don't hold war now, but here are my complaints. And now, well, Stalin is dead now, and maybe even Soviet Union is already fallen, but here are my complaints. I always need more for happiness, you know, not just food and now not just, you know, stuff for my children. Now I need love or psychic freedom. And so I think in the story that we're discussing, she's constantly comparing herself to foreigners, to the way her mother, grandmother lived, but also after spending that trying night in the communal apartment, and when she comes back home, she appreciates that domestic little heaven that she's made to herself. It's a certain, I don't want to say a compromise, but it's a certain, it's definitely a little piece of happiness for her. And just the other idea of beauty in, say, Leningrad, of beauty that she thinks the Italian is exposed in, and a beauty of her home life that is a certain kind of beauty too.
We are visiting with Ksenia Melnik, and she is the author of Snow in May, a collection of stories about men and women, mostly women, in Magadan, an isolated fishing and mining town in the northern reaches of Russia. And it's interesting that once served as a transit center for prisoners dispatched to Stalin's labor camps. And you mentioned earlier the fact that the walls were very thin and people had to be very careful, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, and especially in the 50s. However, you talk about that a little bit in Strawberry Lipstick, because mm-hmm. that bride wants to tell her husband something that all of a sudden she realizes where she is and she might be overheard.
That's, I think, is a knee-jerk reaction. And to be honest, even now, Russians have just had such a long experience of the government spying on them and people talking, people spreading rumors and just people not being sure where they stand. Sure, there are moments of greater freedom, like the thaw with Khrushchev and Glasnost in the 80s and the 90s was a much more freedom of press, freedom of speech kind of thing. But I think it is ingrained. And I would not be surprised if even now on the streets, I mean, people, the silent people, that generation from the Stalin times where you didn't talk about your family, you didn't talk about yourself, like you were just silent, you were just oriented about the practical communications. That is past, of course, but I think in the old people now, I think people just have that awareness behind them just in case, you know, don't say something that can be
overheard, misinterpreted
as some criticism of, you know, the government. Of course, that story is Strawberry Lipstick. So the young woman starts out in Stavropol, which is a town in the south of Russia, and she marries a military officer and moves with him to Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky, which is on the peninsula in the eastern part. And, I mean, the stories are not all set in Magadan, but characters all have connections to Magadan. So we find out that this protagonist's daughter is the one who later end up in Magadan. So there is a connection there. But that was only 1958, which is where I set my story. And that is still the hangover from, you know, the Stalinist times. And people are just happy the war's over. The Russia is being slowly rebuilt. People are finally getting enough to eat. But that is still a time where people had to be careful what they said.
We are visiting with Ksenia Melnik. She is the author of Snow in May, a collection of short stories that take us to Eastern Russia and introduce us to various characters. And you mentioned about the war, and this story here kind of brings up a little bit still wartime memories, where the doctor is married off to an American through a secret agency. And so that secret or special agency conjures up memories of the war and communism, all that. Tell us about that story.
I think you were talking about Kruchina.
Yes, Kruchina.
Yes, yes. So it was actually interesting. When I started researching the mail order brides, I noticed that there were a lot of information from the husbands and their experience of finding a Russian bride. But I wanted to write a story and kind of see what it feels like for the wife. But yes, the story is set in the 90s, and it's in Fairbanks, Alaska. She has married this American history teacher who has a particular fascination with Russia. And, you know, is it a little weird? Is it a little macabre? Maybe, wouldn't know. But the woman at that point, she's just looking for a decent companion in life, just not huge, big dreams of love or ecstasy. Just in the 90s when things were falling apart, doctors were not getting paid. She just wants to find a compromise and to find a situation that would provide for a brighter future for her daughter. I mean, I wouldn't really say that it's a secret. This is a secret agency.
A special agency.
A special agency. Yeah, but, you know, these kinds of marriages are interesting to me because they're not always like your stereotypical blonde, you know, bimbo gold digger kind of thing. This woman is very smart and, you know, she's looking for a certain happiness on her own terms.
If you want to find out how this story ends, of course, you'll have to read the book. It's called Snow in May. We are visiting with Ksenia Melnik, and it's a collection of short stories about Russian women, some men, but it's a very interesting
children.
Collection and children, excuse me. It's a very interesting book, and the cover is beautiful. And again, Snow in May, available at various bookstores, wherever you go or online. And you have a website, Ksenia?
I do have to say that there also should be some signed copies left in Barnes & Noble at the Fountains of Air because I had a signing there. Yes, I have a website. It's just my name, KseniaMelnik.com.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been Ksenia Melnik, the author of Snow in May.
We'd like to take the time to thank you, the listener, for making Perspective Summer Book Club here at KTEP a rousing success, so much so that we're going to extend it. And in order to do so, we'd also like to have your input. So if you'll email us or like us on Facebook and send us a message as to who you would like to hear as an author speaking about his or her book, Louis Sines will work hard to get that author on the air for you and all the rest of us to enjoy and listen to. We had post-production help this afternoon from June Urbina, KTEP's newest production assistant. Thank you for listening to this episode of Perspectives.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.